You said you did some political reporting from Tabriz during this period.
Yes, we shared it to some extent. The consul did most because he had obviously much more access to leading people, and he would see a governor general much more often than I would, and he would be involved in high-level meetings and ceremonies all the time. When the Shah came on visits, which he did a couple of times while I was there, if the consul was there, you know, he was the one who was invited to the ceremonies and so on. Although I was invited too, and so I shook the Shah's hand on a couple of occasions. He had more of the exposure, but I did some of the more routine political reporting, like the biographic reporting and factual material on political parties that might start up, political activities that where some research was required, you know, to take the time to study the press or gather background information. But Eagleton was very well checked out on these Kurdish issues, but also on a lot of other issues of government policy, the attitudes of Azerbaijan toward the central government, maybe some interviews occasionally with political figures who were in the Majlis or whatever. He would do something in Tabriz, he would have a line on that. He was succeeded by John Howison, who was another very capable officer who had been in Iran earlier in the Mossadegh period. And Howison also spoke Turkish, so he could make a stab at Azerbaijani Turki. They distinguished between Azerbaijani Turki and Islamboli Turki, which was, you know, the real Turkish, but Azerbaijani Turkish was a sort of variant language. So that's the way we split it up. Mm-hmm.
Did you had contacts in the local government, provincial government there, that you met with from time to time for talk about politics? And mm-hmm. Who were some of the people that you got to know?
Of course, I met the Governor General on a number of occasions, and I would speak with other officials, like the Provincial Chief of Education or the Provincial Head of Agriculture. A lot of my contacts were in relation to land reform, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The political but mainly economic aspects of land reform. So I would go to see Mr. Behbouli, for example. He was the provincial agricultural chief during part of the time I was there.
What was his name again?
Behbouli. Behbudi, I think that's spelled. To get an angle on what was happening in land reform from his standpoint. You know, when it spread from Maragay, it spread eventually out from that pilot area to larger areas of the country. And so then the original methods that were used in Maragay were supposed to be practiced by agricultural officials throughout the country. So whereas first it was a pilot program, then it was spreading out. One of the men that I got to know fairly well down in Maragay was a Mr. Khal Khali, K-H-A-L-K-H-A-L-I, Khal Khali, someone coming from Khal Khal. Uh-huh. He was a career agricultural official from Tehran, a very soft-spoken but very intense guy who really, I thought, had a lot of good ideas. I saw a lot of other officials down there, but he's one who stands out in my mind as a very respected person. Mm-hmm. And so as the land reform program went on, well, first we of course reported on the plans, and then when it was inaugurated, we reported on the specifics of how it was being done, and then when the Shah came up to hand out the first deeds, I wasn't there, but John Hallison was invited, so he went down and observed the affair and reported on all aspects of that. It was fascinating because he was at this affair where the peasants come forward and each one was, and his name was called, step forward to get deeds to his land, and they would all, you know, drop down on their knees and kiss his feet or put their hands on his feet, you know, to grovel before the great man, and then he would majestically lean down and sort of lift them up, you know, just, well, now you can you can come up in the world and you can be one like a real man, and then he would present them the deed, and then of course they would then bow again to him and maybe try to kiss his hand or something, and off they'd go, and the next one comes forward. Well, after all this was over, there was going to be some kind of a luncheon or something, and John said he was looking around for a place to relieve himself, looking for an end room somewhere, and he was going through this building, and he happened to go around a corner and caught a glimpse of the Shah in this room with an attendant swabbing down his arm with alcohol
to clean off the
germs he might have gotten from these peasants who were holding onto his hands and kissing him as they got their deeds. So this is sort of the ambiance of the period. I mean, it was really a dramatic change. And I still, maybe my mind is colored a little bit by nostalgia, but I was really impressed with the beginning of the land reform. I was determined to present an objective view to the department, because I talked to a lot of people in the diplomatic consular community before land reform ever started, and you know, some of them had been there longer than I, so I wanted to get their ideas. And I remember the Frenchman, he just was, you know, just totally dismissing, oh, you know, how the French do something. It was just one more silly thing that was never going to happen. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it won't happen, but I've got to be in a position to at least analyze this. So we started doing a lot of reporting, and John was very good about it. He gave me, you know, free rein to do a lot of research, and of course everything I wrote he had to approve, but I tried to be very methodical about it and report the facts as I got them, and I was interested. I've still got the reference to it upstairs. There's a book put out by the Land Tenure Center up at the University of Wisconsin that's sort of a source book on materials about land reform, and there's a citation there, U.S. Consulate Tabria's reporting with my name, you know, saying there's a series of basic reports on this program, including sample land deeds that were... You see, I went down there and talked to these officials, and I said, I understand you're going to be presenting deeds to the peasants, how you figure it, and all these special terms about the six divisions of a village, some landlords owned many villages, some owned parts of villages that totaled many, many villages, but they were just parts of each village, and so that was called pari kande, which means different parts spread out. There were all kinds of intricacies to the whole subject of land reform, and so I reported everything that I got that I felt was factual, and tried to integrate it into, you know, factual presentations and analyzing what was happening and what we thought of these developments. One neat trick that they did, for example, was they based the valuation of the landlord's villages on what he'd paid in taxes in previous years. So obviously a landlord who had underreported the value of his land for years in order to get minimal taxes would then be told, well, you know, we're going to apply this formula that
you're going to, the value of is X times what you reported over this period of time is the value of your village. And then he would scream, oh my God, you know, you're taking away my villages. And then, well, you know, aha, I mean, here are your returns. You reported the value of your land. So we're just basing it on what you yourself said. I mean, I thought it was a really a clever way to handle it, you know. And they really did, in the beginning, try to not only take the land away from the landlords, which was the easiest part, but they tried to set up a support structure for the villagers. They had cooperatives where they provided seeds and fertilizer and various inputs for cost, and they provided credit. They tried to get the villagers to come forth and form these cooperatives where they put money in and then got services out. And they really, in the early days, did a very good job at that. And I talked to a lot of peasants who were really very excited about the idea that finally this land is going to be theirs. You know, they kept telling all these stories about how they farmed the land for all these years and everything had always been taken away. I mean, I won't go into all these details because it's a very complicated subject that many writers have written on. Ann Lampton and, of course, Hoagland has written a book to have upstairs about land reform. But there are some pessimistic assessments that have been made with which I disagree in the early stages. As I felt the net result in the first year or two of land reform was very positive. I felt that the output of crops actually increased. Now, of course, you have to factor in weather, and as I recall, the weather was favorable the first couple of years of land reform, so that you could say that's a variable that has to be evaluated. But aside from the weather, I felt that the people who got land were going to put a lot more effort into it. And, you know, the landlords spread the word that these peasants really didn't know what to do with the land. They'd always depended on the landlords to tell them what to plant where. And that was really a lot of bull, because I talked to these people and they said, well, the landlord is always away, and his overseer comes to me and says, what do you think about putting in the barley on such and such a day, and I tell him, well, I think maybe we ought to wait another week because of so and so. I mean, these people were experienced on the land. They knew from year to year what had happened. And they were very knowledgeable. The landlord was always away. A few of the good ones would come out and, you know, show some interest in their property, but a lot of them would just live in Tehran, and as long as they got the money from the overseer, they were satisfied. So the overseer or manager was the one who really represented the landlord, and some of them were pretty brutal. Some were fair. I mean, it was a wide range of experience, but I think, generally speaking, the peasants were the ones who really had the know-how. And the idea that they couldn't function without the landlord to guide them is ridiculous.
In terms of the equitable, in terms of what you saw around Azerbaijan and Tabriz, was the distribution of land more equitable after land reform? I mean, substantially more equitable? Or was there still inequities? But
it was much more equitable, yes. Because obviously they started with the most vulnerable people, the landlords who owned hundreds of villages or 30 villages or whatever. So that was more uniformly popular. And obviously, when they got to what they called the second stage, where they started going after the smaller landlords, then they got into a lot of sensitivity, because land was an investment for many people, and you found small merchants or say college professors and all kinds of people who had money would put it into land. So then, when they decided that after taking away all these large landlords, they're going to start going after the people who just own, say, less than a village. Then you got into tramping on a lot of toes, because you've got some guy who said, well, I worked, you know, 30 years in my job, and I spent money as an investment to own part of this village, and now it's going to be part of it taken away from it. It's not fair. So there were a lot of smaller fish who were much less happy about this. The landlords, the big landlords, were obviously sort of an easy target, but when you spread it to smaller holdings, you got into much more unhappiness. But I think basically what happened is just that the pilot program, as good as it was, once it was spread further throughout the country, it was just beyond the resources of the government to maintain this sort of support activity, which they did in America to make a good start. So the land reform became somewhat less effective later on, and Ted Elliott and I wrote a lot about this together. Because when I went to Tehran and after Tabriz, after Homley came back, we did several analyses over time of land reform programs. Myself, or I doing it from the political standpoint, and Ted more from the economic standpoint. Although there's a lot of intermixture, because I did some studies of villages where I had some data from the university in Tehran on specific villages, and I went back to those same villages using sort of benchmark study. Down to considerably tail, like when I would go and call on a particular person, Mr. Abdullahi, for example, whatever the name was, I'd say, "Now, Mr. Abdullahi, I'm here just to find out information about your village. I have these studies that were done by the University of Tehran, and some people talked to you then, and I would like to just see what's changed and get your ideas if you don't mind talking to me." They would always agree, and I would say, "Well, now you had 16 sheep before, and 30 chickens, and this many hectares of land. How are things for you now?" And he'd say, "Well, I've got many more sheep." He just told me all things had changed, and I tried with these studies to get some idea of what was happening at the village level, and there was a lot of progress over time. So anyway, we cooperated on some of these analyses, in which my village studies that were sort of individually done, some conclusions were brought together from those into this reporting that we did, and I think we did a reasonably good job of trying to analyze countrywide how the land reform was progressing.
Was there much of a U.S. technical role in assisting the people in Tehran who were planning the land reform programs? Was there any technical assistance given by the United States?
Very little.
Expedite land reform?
Very little. Because Iran is wanting to make a fair show.
Yeah. They didn't want it to be
American reform. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was some support on a technical level,
I would say. I mean, if they wanted to get better seeds or anything like that, they would ask for some advice and help. But on the ground in America, it was an Iranian show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Arsene Jani was a fantastic character. And,
I was going to ask you about him, actually.
I had a lot of respect for him. And obviously, he got in trouble because he built a base of support by his very energetic pushing of the land reform program. There was the handing out of deeds in Marigay, which he was present at, and then they had a tremendous meeting down in Tehran on the first anniversary of land reform. As I recall, the occasion had a tremendous Congress of the Shah and the people. Is that what it was called? Anyway, it was about land reform, yeah. And the Shah spoke and Arsene Jani spoke. And I think after that, the Shah quickly realized that Arsene Jani was building a sort of base of support that made him vulnerable. Because, you know, that's the historical context in which you operate there, that the ruler is always, there are similes about the wheat field. The ruler looks at his subjects like the wheat field, and as long as they're all at the same level, predictable, then it's okay, but if a few stalks start to grow higher, then he's out there ready to cut them off because he can't afford to have anybody rivaling him. So in that context, once Ashram Jani sort of began to, in Shahjee, to use this program as a political basis support. Not that he was challenging the Shah. He didn't challenge him in any open way. It was all, you know, always your majesty, wise leadership, and so on and so on and so on. But, you know, in the popular mind, Ashram Jani became associated with the success of the land reform program at the beginning. And so the Shah just took him out of the job and sent him off to the ambassador to Italy.
I think some State Department reports from that time, I think early 63, mid 63, when Ashram Jani was on his way down, suggested that there was some concern in Washington that he might be moving too fast on a reform in any case. That he might be upsetting established interests, and there might be problems with investment and his economic instability because he was pushing so fast in the program. Was that a concern in Tehran and among U.S. officials in Iran?
Well,
he was pushing too fast on the issue.
Yes, it was. And, you know, again, I'll show my personal bias because, in my view, this is one of the typical attitudes you get on the part of people who make a profession of agricultural development. I mean, this may sound really, really negative, but I've read a lot of stuff about land reform, and there's a school of thought that says that you can't do anything until you have accurate records. At the beginning of everything, you've got to have a cadastral survey and know exactly who owns what piece of land and so on. Well, in my view, this means you'll never do anything. Because land reform is very difficult anyway. And in every country, there is a complex pattern of how ownership has evolved over the years, and family ownership, and primogeniture rules and everything. I mean, it's just fantastically complicated. And if you say you can't do anything until you have all the analytical tools in place, then you never do anything. And my thought was that Ashram Jani and his people had just the right balance. They went in and they looked at the facts. They tried to get as much information as they could. They really did a lot of basic survey kind of work. But once you decide to do the program, I mean, you've got to take certain facts as given and go on with it, otherwise you'll never do anything. Mm-hmm. And I think the agricultural people in AID were guilty of overemphasis of the structural problems. I mean, sure, land reform is great, but unless they provide support to the farmers, it's going to be terrible because production will go down. And it'll be a disaster, and that's going to fall off. I think that was just not true. Because if you give people the land at which they've been cultivating, and they have help in getting the tools ready that the landlord has been providing, then they work hard and they spend the money that they get. I mean, the money circulates, and I think development will continue to take place. I don't think that you could say that these landlords were an engine of development, because they just took the money down to Tehran and enjoyed going to nightclubs and traveling to France and
sending off the Swiss
banks. Living well and sending to Swiss banks. I mean, they didn't want to invest anything in their villages. They just wanted to take. There were always exceptions. I mean, my dad knows why, because as I spoke to the attaché, he went out and the days when he was there, he got to know a lot of these landlords. And we visited there on occasion. And, a lot of happy peasants who felt that whatever the landlord was, was concerned about them. But there are also an awful lot of cases of total serfdom where people, were required to do couvée labor, just like back in the Middle Ages, the trois de seigneur, where the landlord just took whatever young girls from the village that he wanted and made them servants in his house and used them for his sexual pleasure too. I mean, there were all kinds of variations of good and bad. But I think they took a middle ground there where they said we can't do every kind of detail on surveys, we'll never get started, but we also have to be careful not to be arbitrary, so let's go in there and find out what the land deeds do say. But a lot of things here were just very rudimentary. I mean, you say my boundary goes from this tree over to that big stone there and then over here. I mean, there were the divisions of land among the peasants within the village were often very arbitrary, and sometimes the landlord changed them. He gave a favorite guy better land, and somebody didn't like it, gave him more stony land over here. And so, you know, it was very hard to say even which peasant farmed which land traditionally, because they had been moved around. Mm-hmm. So you had to make some decisions, how are you going to divide things up? And there were some inequities, but in the very beginning, when they saturated this Marigay area with agricultural experts and seeds and fertilizer, they even brought brand new safes into these villages. Mm-hmm. And I saw them, and they installed a safe in this room. Okay, this is now your cooperative fund, and we're going to, for every amount of money that you contribute as villagers, we're going to match it with so much government funds. Mm-hmm. And they did that. Of course, once or twice, people absconded with money, and the whole thing went back to nothing. But there were situations where these cooperatives really worked. So anyway, that's my analysis of land reform. And I think there has been a lot of pro and con reporting over time. I've read Lampkin's books, and I haven't finished Hogan's books, but you know, there are pros and cons to it. Everyone has their own way of analyzing it. But I think some people are a little bit unrealistic in terms of how they see land reform going ahead, and they want too much organization. Mm-hmm. So I think it's got to be there's got to be political impetus there to go ahead with it before all the I's are dotted and the T's crossed.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, you were stating that tourism, 61, 62, I guess, early 63, or most of 63.
Most of 63.
Yeah. How much contact did you have with the embassy in Tehran? Did you visit it from time to time? Or?
Oh, yes. We made frequent trips down to the capital. We went on pouch trips where we carried classified pouches down to the embassy, and we had embassy visitors come up to see us. Some embassy officers would come on sort of familiarization trips. Obviously, being up in Tabriz, it was a big occasion to go to Tehran, go to the commissary and buy food that you couldn't get in Tabriz and bring it back. Whoever went down would bring back stuff for other people, packed in dry ice, you know, frozen meat and things that you couldn't get up there. So there was a lot of back and forth. The reporting situation was such that we reported directly to the department on many issues with the info copy to Tehran. But we also took part in sort of collective analyses of various subjects. We would exchange information. We'd know that the embassy was preparing a report on some subject, and they would be asking our views on various aspects. We would send those in, and they'd become part of it. And then they would be sort of a country view from the embassy, and then they would include subsections from each of the consulates, how things look from their vantage point. So I think it was a very good system, because if you go too far one way or the other, it's bad. I've seen both situations. I've seen where embassies won't let the consulate say anything without turning to them.
Over-centralization.
Over-centralization and a control of thought, which I think avoids spontaneity and frankness in reporting, because if you can't report directly, if everything just gets sent into the embassy and then eventually put together in some package and sent on there, you know, there's no urgency of it. But if you have your own chance to report things, then you put a lot more care into it, because you know that's going to be in the Department of State as Tabriz dispatch tell them so, and you're on the line. If your name is there, you're the writer, and something turned out to be wrong or misanalyzed, then, you know, you're the one whose name is on the line. I think it's a much more productive attitude to have, because if the embassy says everything must come to us first, then, you know, whatever the embassy thinks is going to be the view that goes to Washington. Because the consulates may have quite different views, but it never gets through the combined reporting.
You see the cable traffic between Tehran and Washington when you went to Britain?
Yes.
That was rerouted to the
U.S. Yes, but often after the fact. I mean, you know, the cable would go into to Washington and we would get copies in the pouch. So it had, there had to be these very often pouch trips, whether it was people from the embassy coming up to see us or people in the conference going down there. We traded off.
So you're pretty well apprised of what was going on with
in
Tehran with Ambassador Holmes and so forth.
Yeah.
You met Holmes?
Yes, whenever I would go down, I would be invited to the embassy staff meeting, and you know, he would come up to be invited to comment. I was very impressed with Holmes. Well, he's a tremendous guy.
What were your impressions on? Please elaborate a little bit.
Well, he was extremely open. He took the view that the embassy was supposed to bring ideas upward to him to supplement what he was doing. He was seeing the Shah, he was seeing all the top officials, he was making his own assessments of things, but he expected the reporting of the embassy to be generated from the bottom up, and expected the political section to come forward with views on things which they would ground in the material they were producing based on interviews and press coverage and their own analysis, and then he would decide what flavor to put in the final conclusions, but he depended very much on his staff, and it was a good feeling because everyone felt, you know, they really were part of the team, whatever they said to be listened to. And I had the feeling as a very junior guy, I mean, I was the vice consul coming in from Tabriz, but when I was at one of these embassy meetings, and Holmes would go around the table, he would say, "Art for passing up in Azerbaijan, well, what about so-and-so?" He really took the time to listen. So, you know, you felt like you're part of the team. It was pretty nice feeling.
Mm-hmm. How effective was he as ambassador from your vantage point?
I think it was extremely good because, you know, the Shah was an imposing figure, even back at that time. I mean, obviously, as his country became more wealthy, he became even more imperious and eventually crowning himself and all these things that you know about. But even back then, in this period, 61, 63, you know, he'd come back with CIA help in 53, and now this was, what, 8 years later, and although he was a little bit, I think, always less at home in domestic politics than he was in international politics, still, he was very forceful, I always joked about it because I felt that his routine with every new ambassador was to attack, you know, from the moment the ambassador walked in. He would always have a list of complaints, you know, and as soon as the new ambassador would come in to present credentials and have his first meeting, the Shah would go into this list. Why is this happening? Why are you doing that? Why? What's happening here? You know, just sort of putting the ambassador on the defensive right from the start. And if you weren't careful, you could become just a conduit for every view that the Shah had, you know, just going back to Washington, we've got to do this and this and this and this because these are things that are upsetting the Shah this month. And Holmes didn't play that game. Holmes listened to what he was told, and then he would come back and say, "Well, the man, you know, fine, you know, what do we do about that? But this other thing, you know, we've got to talk about that." And he would give his views and his side of things, and I think that was important for the Shah to have a bit of give and take. Unfortunately, his successors, several in a row did not have that same filter. They just, you know, whatever the Shah was all reported back to Washington in sort of breathless fashion. He's upset about nothing. We've got to do all these things. I think it was bad because the Shah got in the habit of the laundry list of complaints and always putting in random ambassador on the defensive.
But Holmes, that wasn't such a problem.
That wasn't such a problem. Partly it was Holmes' experience in the past. He was a senior military officer and had worked in the World Fair preparations and had done a lot of things. But his personality was just very firm with people, willing to listen to your side of things, but not. He's not going to be just overwhelmed by whatever you said. He took it aboard, analyzed it. It was a very good give and take. Mm-hmm. At whatever level you were, let's say as a junior officer, I was impressed because he listened to me just as intently as he listened to the political counselor if I was in a meeting. That was impressive.
Mm-hmm. He visited Tabriz from time to time, Ambassador Holmes.
Yes. But I wouldn't be able to tell you how many times.
Yeah, but that's what
there's a lot of pressure to stay in Tehran. Yeah. There's always something going on. Visiting dignitaries in the States. And royal audiences all the time. Yeah.
Who were some of the other officials of the embassy that you would deal with when you were working out of Tabriz? Who are some of the people on Holmes' staff that you got to work with or got to know?
I would work with any one of the counselors, but I knew them, but I didn't have a great deal of contact because the consul would be interacting more with the political section chief or the economic section chief. I would on occasion, obviously, and they were seeing my reporting and so on, but it wasn't that direct a channel. Mm-hmm. And we did have a person functioning as a consular coordinator. Who was
liaison.
Yeah, liaison with all the consulates and sort of find out what our plans were for reporting and turn tell us the kind of reports that Washington and the embassy might like to have.
Who was that?
Well, I'm afraid you're going to ask because
that's okay.
I can't dredge up the name right now.
Okay. Were there people? Did people from Washington come and visit Tabriz? Officials, congressmen, whatever. Was that an occurrence? Not much.
Very rare. The head of GTI, Greece, Turkey, Iran, which is a division in those days. She came out just as I was about to leave Tabriz because Howison was leaving and he was being considered as her deputy. Mm-hmm. And so she came out on an inspection tour allegedly and looked around and see what was happening around. We went together and took her down to Clara Day, looking on the land reform program and so on.
What's her name? I've seen
Kay Bracken.
Yeah, Bracken. Right.
But I think, logically, the main reason for coming out was just to see the house in action, see what kind of post he ran, and see if he would be a people deputy, which he then became. Mm-hmm.
How much information did you get about policy developments going on in Washington concerning Iran? I mean, did you get a sense of what the task force was doing? The Iran Task Force in 61 was doing, and the direction of policy.
Sure, because we got copies not only of telegrams from the embassy to Washington, but all the Washington traffic out to Tehran would be info copies for the consulate thrown off, and so we would have them in the pouch. So we get a good idea of the exchange back and forth on policy issues. And we needed that, obviously, if we were going to make any kind of contribution from our vantage point.
What were your impressions of U.S. policy towards the Shah at this under the Kennedy administration? You mentioned a few things earlier about sort of pressure, generalized pressure for reform. Were there any other factors that might be worth discussing?
Well, there were wide swings in opinion toward our policy. I don't know if you've ever interviewed Bill Miller.
I've been suggested, but I haven't met him. No.
Well, Bill, to my way of thinking, was way off in one extreme, on a liberal extreme. He felt that it had been a total mistake to bring the Shah back, and that even having done so, knowing what that result of that was in terms of the nationalist opposition and so on, that we could cut our losses if we would immediately adopt support toward all these nationalistic people coming along. We call them the young Iranians or something like that.
He was a political officer at the embassy.
Yeah.
At this time, early 60s.
Well, actually, he was in Istanbul.
Oh, okay.
First, and then he came to Tehran. But I met him early on, and we talked about our attitude. And as I said, I considered him to be one extreme, you know, because he felt like that certain National Front people like Hossein Mahdi and Firouz Khaini, and how many people that he got to know, that these were the real wave of the future. These were, you know, bright, Western educated, forward thinking, liberal type Iranians who we should support. Mm-hmm. And that, we owed it to the future of the country to get behind the nationalist opposition and really support them as a challenge to the Shah. That if the Shah didn't do a better job of, making progress in Iran, it would help all the people, that we should throw our support behind the National Front. And he kept arguing this in reporting and so on, to the extent that he eventually left the service after coming back to Washington and still trying to push these ideas. And he was relentless. He never gave up. You know, no matter how it went, he kept pushing his line. And even when reporting was concluded, that like a briefing book, for the secretary's visit overseas, I mean, he would still go around and try to get someone to insert another view in the briefing book that would show his point of view. He really was a very skillful bureaucratic player. But anyway. I felt he was one extreme, that you just couldn't expect us to suddenly say, well, the Shah has had it, we're going to support the National Front. Then there were other people on the other extreme who felt that the Iranians could never do anything on their own unless they had a strong leader. And all ideas came from the Shah. That was what I would call the linchpin theory, or the keystone theory. These terms turned up in a lot of embassy reporting over the years. And when I was down there later in the political section, I considered Martin Hirsch to be pretty much in that, if you will, more conservative or right-wing approach. But, I mean, he listened to all of us more junior people who spoke Farsi and had much more contact with Iranians, except the top.
Yeah.
The top people with whom he had contact. He considered all of us sort of, idealistic young officers who should be allowed to go out and use our energy getting out and finding out what's going on. But, when it comes to reporting to Washington, sort of temper these young guys, radical views, and give a more objective view, which turned out to be that despite all the things that were going on, the Shah was really the only one we had to support him, and there really wasn't anything else. He was a linchpin.
Where did Holmes fit into this spectrum of opinion, if you can tell?
Well, you see, when I mentioned Hertz, he represented a change. He came in as political counselor just as I was finishing my tour.
So after Holmes had left. Oh, okay, I see.
Well, I think he overlapped with him, but Simon Holmes. But it was late in the game when he came, and he was a bit reluctant to take positions at the beginning, Hertz, because he wanted to find out about what was going on. He was very, very smart guy, very analytical. So he didn't want to make any commitments early on. So that was the time when Holmes was there, and it was pretty much as it had been, with information being assembled, passed up the line, and it was good reporting going out of there. I obviously, from what I said, felt there was some middle ground between these two extremes. I mean, I felt we went too far in supporting the Shah in everything that he wanted. You know, after he complained he had, even down to PL480 wheat and whatever he wanted. You know, we were, for years they were just jumping, providing everything. I felt that we should have been more demanding on the Shah when we were supporting him. Economically, militarily, politically, I mean, we should have said that certain things had to be done. I mean, we're going to pull strings to have specific things done, but in general, we wanted certain types of progress in the country. And if we didn't see something along that line.